people today who use this term, just war, usually try to define it in terms of guilt and innocence. You know, there's one nation that's guilty and there's one nation that's innocent. And if a nation goes to war in innocence, then it is engaged in a just war. The trouble is that the ideas of guilt and innocence just do not fit the actions of nations. Ask yourself, is the aggressor nation the one that's guilty? Okay, suppose you say it is. You say it. A just war is a defensive war. A defensive war means a war that is fought against an aggressor, because the aggressor is guilty. Who's the aggressor? Is it the country that struck first? What if this country struck in order to forestall a strike? You know, your enemy is rolling his tanks up to the frontier, and you quickly strike in order to blunt his attack. Who's the aggressor? Or suppose that you strike in order to remedy the consequences of past aggression. You see, he whucked you 10 years ago. And now finally, you've mustered enough strength to get back what he took from you. Who's the aggressor? Moreover, you have to remember that aggression takes on myriad guises. Right? It runs from blatant to extremely subtle, from an infantry attack through a blockade to a veiled threat. All of these are forms of aggression. But where do guilt and innocence lie between Israel and the Arab world? India, Kashmir, or in Vietnam? Who is really innocent? I doubt if there has ever been a war in which each country involved could not claim that it was in the right, that it was the offended party, that it was innocent, and therefore that its cause was just. You see, wars reflect conflicts of interest. The very fact that a country goes to war proves that it believes its cause is just. In such a situation, where everybody believes his cause is just, the attempt to assess degrees of guilt and innocence turns out, I think, to be empty logic chopping. It's question begging at best, and at worst, it's self-righteousness and hypocrisy. What I've said that is that people with any sensitivity, with any awareness of the way in which men can rationalize their interests, have gotten pretty sick and tired of hearing about just wars. Because it always turns out a just war is our war. And that, you know, when we pray in the litany, give to us perpetual victory over all our enemies. Some pastors, I used to do this myself, would insert, give to us in all just causes perpetual victory over all our enemies. Until I finally realized that I wasn't really saying it. Because I always believed that, we inevitably believe that our cause is just. These nations do, or they wouldn't go to war. That doesn't mean that there aren't some people in the nation who will say our cause is unjust. But if the nation moves to war, mobilizes for war, and engages in war, risks lives, and gives up lives, and obviously the nation believes that it has some kind of just cause. So we've had an inevitable reaction. The growth of cosmopolitanism, the increased habit of looking skeptically upon our own moral claims, a habit that I think has been growing among us, cultural relativism, and a host of other factors have undermined the concept of just war for a lot of sensitive and educated people. They see it as a big hypocrisy. People today don't argue when you say, for example, that we are engaged in a just war. They laugh. There's laugh when somebody claims that a particular war is just. Of course, the mass of people, I think, go on believing that any war in which their country is engaged is just. But I'm talking about educated and sensitive, Holden Village type people. They sort of snicker when somebody talks about the just war. The problem now, though, is with this reaction that if there's no such thing as a just war, then it seems that we ought all to be pacifists if we're consistent. But pacifism is not, I'm looking right at Dr. Baton now, who comes out of the tradition, a very honorable and difficult tradition. Pacifism is not an easy position to hold. And Dr. Baton, I've heard him talk. Ways that indicate that it's not an easy position to hold. anyway, it would seem that if there is no such thing as a just war, oh, we Christians ought all to be pacifists. But it's very, very difficult to be a pacifist without gross inconsistency. Not very many people are pacifists, from which it follows that there may, after all, be such a creature as a just war. Let me put it less paradoxically. If our logic does not compel us to adopt the pacifist position, all war is wrong. War should never be fought. A Christian cannot engage in war, nor contribute to his nation's war effort. If our logic does not compel us to adopt this position, then we are somehow granting the possibility of a justifiable war. And this is what I want to explore, the concept of justifiable war. Under what circumstances is war justifiable? And I want to conclude that there is today an urgent need to resurrect the concept of the just war in the humbler garb of the unfortunately necessary war. I want to bury the concept of war as ever a good thing, a righteous thing, which is implicit in the adjective just. That's not what I'm trying to suggest. But I want to restore the concept, the vital notion, I believe, for our time of war as necessary evil. There are many people who will object. They'll say war needs no justification, and they are right. War needs no justification, but it does need limitation. And that is what the concept of the just war may help us to provide, a way of limiting war. This is what I'm about. I am not trying to justify war. I hope nobody misunderstands when that comes. I am very, very much concerned that we maintain and develop our capacity to limit war so that we do not commit mass murder. Right? People say all's fair in love and war. And I think this proverb gives an important clue to the nature of war. There is war is conflict in the absence of law. Right? That's what we mean by war. There is no law, and so conflict occurs. Law means rules governing conduct with appropriate sanctions. The declarations of the United Nations are not law because there are no effective sanctions. Resist not evil is not law for the same reason. International law is a misnomer, most men. International laws don't exist because the sanctions don't exist. I know we talk a lot about international law. What do you mean by international law? I'm saying that law exists only when there are sanctions. There is no one to decide the facts, apply the law, and make the decisions stick in the international realm. Maybe there should be, but I think the fact is that there is not. When we say all's fair in war, we mean that there is no law to determine what is permissible and what is not, to enforce the rules of the game. The fact of war, the phenomenon of war, which no one can deny, it's just there, testifies to the absence of international law. Well, people say, all right, if that's so, why not establish an international law? Well, that would be lovely. Why not bring nations under the rule of law and thus abolish war? It would be a fine idea, but can it be done? The lawgiver has to be stronger than every prospective lawbreaker if you are to establish the rule of law. Right? Reflect upon these things. I'm not trying to make these statements are not wild. I'm suggesting that these are statements that are confirmed by your own experience if you just think about it. When you have law, when he who gives the law is stronger than every prospective law breaker, law is obeyed as law because insofar as it is in the interest of the law obeyer to do it. The crucial test of whether you have the rule of law comes when someone finds that the decision of law is contrary to his interest. In that moment comes the crucial test. In that moment, he must see that the power of the lawgiver, whether it is the power to punish him, reward him, the power to hold everyone else to the rule and thus ensure order and thus benefit him, or whatever kind of power, he must see in this moment, when the decision of the law goes against him, that the power of the law is sufficient to make it in his interest to obey, despite the fact that he ardently wishes the law were different from what it is. This is the crucial test for the possibility of law. When you do not have this situation, I don't see how you can have law. I'm not trying to exaggerate the importance of naked force or pure coercion, I'm pretending that it is not true that we obey the laws because we always see the policeman standing back there with the book. We obey the law most of the time because there's no reason not to obey the law. But the crucial test comes when you don't want to obey. The crucial test comes when the judge hands down a property settlement that just makes you furious. Then what do you do? Do you start a civil war? Do you obey or do you disobey? If you obey, then you have a rule of law. But why does law, in this sense, seem to exist today only within countries but not among countries? Why is this? The answer can be stated simply, though it's no simple answer. Within a nation, there usually exists a community of interests such that overwhelming power can be marshaled against anybody who continues to assert his private interest contrary to the decision of law. Thus, I don't like the decision of the court. I say it's unjust, but I have to bow anyway. So I believe that my neighbor's pear tree, which is dropping pears all over my lawn and causing flies and bees to infest my yard, I think those pear trees ought to be cut down. I go to court and I say, I'm out there with an act, I'm about to chop it down, and he gets an injunction, we go to trial, and I am restrained and joined from ever cutting down his pear tree, and I say, God is in his heaven, I have been undone. But if I do not go out there and chop that pear tree down, we have a rule of law. If I do not bow, then I revolt. But I can't really expect to mount a successful revolution on behalf of my claim. Of course, if enough people identify with me, if enough males feel that they're getting squashed in divorce settlements, possible that we could get a revolution. The males would all unite and they would march on something and overturn the law. Something like this is occurring in the Negro communities today, where there is a large enough group of people, particularly at certain crisis moments, who feel that they are not bound by the law, that the law is just contrary to their interests, and who have in this particular time and place enough power to challenge the law, and we have a breakdown of law and order. And for at least a period of time in some of our cities, we do not have the rule of law. But whenever a large group of people feel that it is not in their interest to obey the law, and they gather together and revolt, then the rule of law ceases to exist. But then, by definition, the community of interest doesn't exist, so that there's no longer a real nation. Then law ceases to be law. Then we have war, and we call it civil war. And so the situation between, there are parallels between a nation and international affairs. Some things that we call nations do not really have law. Nigeria today, is there a law ruling Nigeria? Obviously there is not. There are several nations there because there are several communities of interest, and so there are several rules of law. In this country, prohibition, I think, provides a fairly dramatic example. To some extent, this nation, the nation didn't really disintegrate in the 1920s, but the prohibition law was unenforceable. But we were somehow able to separate this law out in part from the rest of the law, and we refused to invoke overwhelming force against the violators of the prohibition law because we felt, nothing at least, that the communal interest wasn't seriously enough threatened by violation of this particular law. So the prohibition law was largely not law, but it was just a kind of a pious or impious hope. Now, international law today is nothing but pious hope, because there does not exist in our world tragic fact. I wish it were not so, but I think we have to pay attention to the facts. There does not exist in our world today a community of interest such that overwhelming power can be marshaled against any nation that continues to assert its particular interest contrary to a decision of the UN General Assembly or the World Court or whatever body is supposed to lay down decisions in international disputes. The thing is, there is no power in the world capable of calling the United States to account, or Russia, or China, or even some much weaker nations. No power capable of doing it. There's no power in the world today capable of calling France to account. Capable means not only having the power, but also being willing to muster it and employ it. Nations today are, in large part, sovereign. They are a law unto themselves. International law cannot really create the one world which so many of us have dreamed, but rather one world, one community of interest will become a reality. Well, when it becomes a reality, it will create international law. Law grows from the existence of communities. You can't create communities by first fashioning law. So a lot of Scott Burns have killed me on that. But that day, when there's an international community of interest, is still obviously a long way off. And the problem of 1968 is, what are we going to do in the interim? Nations are sovereign. There is no body of law, no set of procedures by which they can effectively arbitrate their disputes. They're going to have disputes. Conflicts of interest do arise all the time, all over the place. Is every conflict of interest to be allowed to lead to war? Shall nations be allowed to destroy the world because they're unwilling to settle their disagreements without resort to war? That's the question. It always comes back. You often hear the matter put that way, a sort of desperation. But the question, I think, really prejudged the issue. Because every international conflict of interest does not, in fact, lead to war. The amazing thing is how many conflicts of interest are settled without resort to war. Nations do, by and large, settle their disagreements rationally. Very often, a crisis is the consequence of a particular way of looking at something. And I think we have, especially since the dropping of the first atomic bomb, we have developed a kind of crisis mentality with respect to international affairs because of our way of looking at things. We're always looking at the worst thing that could possibly happen. We looked at those disputes which did issue in armed conflict. And we did not pay sufficient attention to all of those disputes which did not lead to armed conflict, and noticed how armed conflict was avoided, how these disputes were resolved. How are they resolved? How do nations usually resolve conflicts of interest? Well, they do it through the techniques of diplomacy, of which war is one. Suppose that every nation, we have no body of international law, suppose now that every nation pursues its own interest. Suppose that every nation pursues its interest with singleness of mind and careful calculation. Reflect for a moment on what this would mean. If each nation, or the executive branch, whatever body in the nation is responsible for making and conducting foreign policy. Suppose in every nation, foreign policy was a matter of the careful, prudent, intelligent, rational, single-minded pursuit of the national interest. What would happen? Many people immediately say, we just have fights and struggles all over the place. But would we really? It wouldn't mean continual war. Wouldn't it more likely mean no war at all? Because given perfect knowledge and perfect rationality, there would be no war. War is contrary to the interests of the participants. War is the result of a mistake, of a misassessment of the situation on somebody's part. In a world of perfect knowledge and rationality, disputes would be settled. Well, it'd sort of be settled the way two boys settle something. There's a big boy and a little boy. And the big boy says, that's mine. The little boy says, no, it's mine. The big boy says, I say it's mine. Now what do? They size it up, the little boy says. Well, if I fight him, he'll get it, and I'll also get a bloody nose. Now, so the big boy gets it. No fight. As long as they're both being rational. But now suppose the little boy just goes off his, you know, he blows his lid. He says, my vital interest. It's immoral. And so he tears into the big one and you have a fight. And it's a mistake. It's irrational. And you say, well, gee, that implies the big boys are going to get everything. Well, the fact is in our world that the big boys do tend to get more than the little boys. That's the way it goes. Let's look at it. But the big boys don't get everything because, you see, the big boy doesn't really want to fight either. I'm assuming that there's not complete disproportion in their sizes. The big boy is going to get a few bruises too. And he knows that there's some point beyond which it is not in his interest to push the little boy. The big boy will take what he really wants, but he'll let the little boy have those things which maybe the little boy wants a lot worse than the big boy wants them, because he too is interested in avoiding the fight. And while this analogy limps, as all analogies do, I think it does help to explain what goes on between nations, or what would go on if nations were rational and single-minded in the pursuit of their national interests. Most conflicts of interest between nations are settled in roughly the way that I suggested that these two little boys settle their disputes. You can say, and it's true, war arises from conflict of interest between nations. But I think it is just as true and more helpful as we think about the problem of war and how to control it. It's more helpful to note that war arises from ignorance and irrationality. Well, if war arises from ignorance and irrationality, it follows logically, and it is my main contention this morning, that the way to limit war in our world is to get the weapons of diplomacy, including war as one technique of diplomacy, into the hands of knowledgeable and rational men. What does that mean? That means war and diplomacy should be conducted by men who will pursue the interests of the nation they represent or rule intelligently. Not morally, but intelligently. Not morally, because nations do not have moral interests. There is no such thing as a moral war. I don't know how there can be. Nations have no morality. Their interests are neither moral nor immoral. I do not know what it means even to talk about the morality or the immorality of a collective. We just don't use the word moral in that way. But in any event, if you're determined to define the word moral in some way, if you can use it to apply to collectivities, I don't know how you can ever say that given the kaleidoscopic complex of private interests within any particular nation, which leads to a given definition of the national interest, I don't know how you can ever decide that that's moral or immoral. And when the President of the United States or the leader of any country decides that it is in the national interest to pursue this, to secure this, defend this, promote this, I don't see how you can ever call that moral or immoral. You can call it wise or unwise. There are lots of adjectives that you can apply to it. But how can you call it moral or immoral? We just don't use the word moral or immoral in this way. You might say, well, moral means to sacrifice yourself or other people. Is a moral action one in which the President of the United States sacrifices the nation? Now, it makes sense to say if the President sacrifices himself, that's moral. I can understand what that means. But I cannot understand why it would be moral for the President of the United States to sacrifice the interests of the nation to somebody else. You turn around and say it's immoral, it's irresponsible, he's not doing what we elected him to do. If you give your money away to the poor, I can understand what you mean when you say that is moral. But if I make you, if I choose you as the executive to manage my trust fund, and you give that away to the poor, I fail to see that that's moral. A war that is fought with careful and realistic attention to the national interest is the kind of war that I am interested in seeing in our world. Not because I am interested in war, but because it seems to me that conflicts of interest do arise, and that if all diplomacy is conducted with this kind of rational, intelligent, single-minded devotion to the national interest in mind on the part of all rulers of nations, we are going to keep war within manageable and tolerable bounds. Wars, if they break out in such a context, will be limited wars. They'll be brief tests of strength. They'll be probes and thrusts rather than headlong confrontations. Now, all this probably may strike you as excessively abstract, or maybe just obvious. But I think, I make this concrete, if you review the history of the last 50 years, you discover that our world has been brought repeatedly to the brink of catastrophe, sometimes on over, because diplomacy has passed out of the hands of the professionals, these rational, knowledgeable, intelligent men. It has passed out of their hands into the hands of amateurs and demagogues. And as a consequence, the touchstone of national interest, meticulously adhered to, has been more and more abandoned. The United States, since at least the time of Woodrow Wilson, has not used the national interest as the criterion of foreign policy. We have preferred ideologies of various sorts. Freedom, democracy, socialism, justice, and all the other friendly virtues. These have been the criteria of our foreign policy. We aren't the only ones who are guilty. Communism is an ideology that has caused some nations to abandon the limiting principle of national interest in favor of world revolution, wars of national liberation, and similar incendiary goals. Unfortunately, in our world, nations are not pursuing their national interests, but they're pursuing ideology, utopian hopes. Nations today, tragically, are trying to make the whole world over. They're trying to bring in their own version of the kingdom of God. This is the thing that really threatens to blow us all up. The United States' response to the ideology of communism has become a counter-ideology. We talk about, we're in Vietnam for the principle of self-determination of peoples, or universal democracy, or to bring free enterprise to the South Vietnamese. These are slogans. This is moralism. This is ideology. It is grossly inappropriate. It is nonsense, and it is dangerous. If there is a good reason for us to be in Vietnam, it can only be that our national interest requires our presence there. If in the 1950s we had been less the captives of ideology and the slogans that John Foster Dulles did so much to fasten upon us, I don't think, I may well be wrong, I don't think that we would have gotten involved. I think we got involved in Vietnam because we were playing Messiah in the world. And we did it because we did it out of the goodness of our heart. We really wanted to make the world better. We really felt that those people down there in South Vietnam, they deserved freedom and justice and a fair chance. And Ho Chi Minh, he's going to be mean to them and all that. We went in for good reasons. And look what we got into. Nations seem never to go to war except for good reasons. But there's really only one good reason, and that is the national interest. War can be limited. War can be kept within bounds, I think. It can be preserved as a technique of diplomacy and a check against tyranny. Remember, war is not the only evil. But only when nations employ war for the protection and the assertion of national interests, interests which are carefully, calmly, and realistically assessed. The unjustifiable war, as it turns out, is the war that is fought in the name of morality. And that's, my conclusion is paradoxical. If you really hate war, stop condemning war as immoral. Because you imply that war can be moral. You imply that there can be wars which are moral, good, a piece of God's work to do. And that is the thing that I think threatens to blow our world up. It's risen, it's become very common in the last 50 years, largely because of the popularization of war. Because in order to wage the kind of total wars that modern technology seems to demand, it's been necessary for presidents to go to legislatures to get huge appropriations. That means you have to rouse up all of the people and get them to think that the enemy is the devil incarnate. And then you launch vast crusades, you know, Eisenhower's crusade in Europe. Then you fight a war to a point of unconditional surrender because he is totally villainous and we are totally virtuous. How many lives were needlessly lost in World War II because that war was prolonged? How long, I don't know, but it was definitely prolonged in the European and Asiatic theaters because we decided, in the name of morality, to fight it to the point of unconditional surrender. And so having reduced these demonic Nazis and demonic Japanese to their knees at the cost of hundreds of thousands of additional lives, we then had to use our resources to raise them up again. I talk more.
I remember hearing President Eisenhower one time in the press conference sort of commenting on an unprepared, in a way that he wasn't speaking from a prepared text. He said, well, why are we in Vietnam after all? He said, well, you know, it's really in our interest. There are a lot of mineral deposits there. There's tin and tungsten, and engaging the reaction. He said, well, of course, we're there for freedom, too. And, I wonder if perhaps we didn't get into Vietnam out of our national interest, and maybe fighting it became apparent that it really wasn't in our national interest and out of some kind of pride or something, it's been prolonged. But I wonder, if national interest isn't a very dangerous standard because it's so difficult to determine just exactly what is in our national interest, and we're going to really make a lot of mistakes. We don't have any clear guidelines when we look at national interest. Isn't, running the world in your national interest ultimately?
No, definitely not. It is not. Look, Russia tried to run Eastern Europe. And look at all the trouble she brought to herself. This, by the way, Kennan was saying this in the late 1940s. Kennan was saying, look, cool it. Russia has bitten off more than she can chew. She's going to get a massive case of indigestion. Let her go. But you say, but these people are in tyranny. They're subjected. They're slaves. That may be true, but that's a moral consideration. And nations have no business doing anything for moral reasons. It was clearly in the interest of the United States not to roll Russia back in 1947-48. We would have lost too much, risked too much. We didn't have enough to gain. And so, fortunately, we stayed on. And now Russia has developed. But the United States has tried to, rule the world with foreign aid every place and make everybody democratic and free. And look at the indigestion we've gotten. But we don't seem to have learned the lesson. Now we're afraid every time the Chinese expand, then we say they're going to rule the world, forgetting that it is not in the interest of a nation to rule the world. You've got too many responsibilities that you cannot fulfill. You tax your resources.
But that's really the problem. I'm saying that, if you could do it well, it would be in your interest to rule the world. But so you say it's in our national interest to rule the world, and then you're doomed to all kinds of mistakes because you really don't have any. It's such a complicated road of the Jews.
Right.
And isn't it in your national interest to exterminate the Jews? Because they're no good,
These are terribly important questions, but I think my answer is no, but I can't adequately explain it in a short period of time, and I don't want to be. I love talking to you about this.
Well, he's right in knowing that your next problem is to define national interest. Walter Lippmann said we've got no national interest to defend in Asia, but we do in Santo Domingo and Cuba. Now, and there you may say that that's not too big a bite for us to chew. apparently you say it's not in the national interest to bite off more than you can chew. But if they, you can chew it, it's in your national interest to take over. Well, how about Cuba and Santo Domingo then? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say it is in our national interest to take over if we can chew it and if it tastes good enough. That, I know that sounds terrible and immoral.
Of course it does, it is.
let's take the question of Cuba. What is the U.S. interest in Cuba? Now, do we really, you see, I don't feel that we do have a national interest to take over Cuba. I think we have a national interest. Our national interest requires us, perhaps, you see, I lack the intelligence myself to define the national interest. Intelligence in two senses, a proper flow of information and reasoning capacity. And if I think I have a great reasoning capacity, I know I don't have a proper flow of information. But I think it's reasonably safe to say that the United States would have a national interest in preventing Cuba from having missiles that could reach our shores. But beyond that, well, you say, well, gee, we, you know, they took over some of our industries. But see, here is where the executive has to define the national interest. Suppose that Castro did take over some of our firms there. So some of our citizens lost something. That's contrary to our national interest. But wouldn't we lose more in trying to get it back? If we would, then it is in our national interest to let Cuba alone.
You're back on St. Augustine, who said that the justice of the war must be determined by the prince. You're saying the justice of the war should be determined by the professional diplomats, by Rusk and Rostov, and maybe LBJ.
I am.
Because we don't know enough.
I am.
Now, of course, in some respects, you're saying what Luther said. He said in politics he would prefer a wise knave to a stupid saint. I think that's a good judgment. But when it comes to leaving to the professional diplomats, the trouble is that they, as you say, can see, think only in terms of national interest. And national interest means largely military security and also ability to control world financial resources. So it gets to be pretty much national interest becomes pretty selfish. You say you can't expect idealism on the part of nations. I'm not convinced of that. What would you say with regard to India and Rhodesia right now? Is it to her interest to try, not by war, but even by sanctions, to force more justice for the blacks in Rhodesia?
I don't know for sure. Because England's interest is very, very complicated here. And if she doesn't take certain steps against Rhodesia, she will antagonize people whom she doesn't want to antagonize because of all the disastrous consequences of antagonizing. I don't know, but I suspect it is not in England's interest, national interest. I suspect.
In other words, she's doing something that's not in her national interest. Mm-hmm. Ariel, therefore, a nation may do something that's not in its national interest. You had just said a while back that it never would.
No, I said it shouldn't. Unfortunately, nations do.
I thought you said it never would.
Maybe I misspoke. Nations do, and I think increasingly in our time, nations conduct foreign policy on the basis of criteria that go way beyond national interest. These so-called moral criteria. I suspect that Britain's very limited intervention, sanctions against Rhodesia, are a result of moral fervor. The feeling of a large number of people, including Englishmen, that this is just a terribly unjust thing that's going on in Rhodesia, and they've got to do something.
Well, people may be mistaken with regard to the to their morality and so on, but you have conceded that nations will practice morality, but you think they shouldn't. They should operate only on the basis of self-interest. And so if there's any morality in it, it will be that the self-interest will balance each other and you'll come out as Machiavelli said, by a, there'll be a certain justice through the balance of injustices.
Right. Yeah, I'm proclaiming Machiavelli. That's all they've lived. I didn't think that Machiavelli was right.
Well, of course, the next thing to do will be to ask whether a Christian can say that. And you get yourself into a nice dichotomy, I think, between a Christian and the ethic that you were expounding.
Well, you know how I bail out on that. doctrine of the two
kingdoms. Of course, it may not be fair to push you on that point, but I think there are points where the Christian may have to dissociate himself from public policy. That may, he may have to do it privately, but he can't endorse what the principle on which nations operate. That may lead you to private pacifism. You sent me a video like Speakman years ago who said that when the war was on, he said we must not beat Japan too badly, we'll need her against China. We must not beat Germany too badly, we'll need her against Russia. Make no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just keep the balance of power. Now he thought that that would make for justice and for peace because of the balancing principle. He said there's a certain ultimate justice that will emerge out of letting each one pursue its own interests. And their checks on each other will cause a certain kind of justice to emerge. I think probably might be about the same thing too. But never take a risk.
Well,
with regard to your self-interest in the case of the nation. I don't think you'll ever take a big risk. I don't think you'll ever take enough risk to meet its own extinction. That's more than you can ever expect from a nation. But it may deliberately do some things that will mean a curtailment of power or a giving up of property interests because of an idea. And although there are a lot of people who get us into trouble by being so cocksure about their ideas and what's good for other people, nevertheless, I wouldn't rule out the concept of idealism in politics.
Well, Dr. Bain, I feel a little bit maybe like Vern Ricci here, who talks about law and never gets love in here. There is a role, a very limited role, that idealism and morality play.
Mm-hmm.
It shapes the national interest, finally.
Mm-hmm.
Through a Christian nation, we can talk about such things.
Well, let's say
a nation which is more rather than less permeated by principles that are somewhat consistent with the Christian outlook.
Right.
will I think be a nation which has an interest somewhat more we will take more delight in sending relief to the victims of an earthquake disaster than we will in parading our ships around the sea lanes of the world. There is a point, for example, when the executive branch of the nation, let's say, gives American resources to other nations, there is a sense in which this is in the national interest, in that it pleases many of us to be able to do this good.
It's partly the national interest, and it's partly pure humanity, because an immense amount of relief was sent privately, which shows that people do it even if government hasn't decided to. It's mixed.
Of course, people always have a right to do it, but we do elect the president not to give away our resources or to sacrifice our interests, but to protect our interests.
Yeah, we don't want to go too far. In Nairobi, I met the Israelis who were doing foreign aid work in Nairobi, and I was told they're doing some of the finest foreign aid work in Africa, and I wondered whether it was to throw a ring of sympathy around the Arab world or whether it was genuine philanthropy. That's a little hard to say.
Sometimes it's better not to ask, it's better just to be grateful.
Well, that may be true. I talked to some of those Israelis, and one of them said to me, he said, during the war, he said, I was in prison, I was a resistance worker, this was my religion. Now we have succeeded better than I ever dreamed, and I have nothing for which to live so passionately. But I do love these Africans.
What about treaties? What about foreign aid? Now, foreign aid, we're giving away on a national scale.
Many of the people who like to talk about the immoral Vietnam War are the same people who will talk about the morality of massive foreign aid programs. Well, one of the things that they forget is that any foreign aid involves necessarily, it entails intervention in the domestic affairs of another country. just to give aid to a nation is to shore up the existing regime. That is intervention, and that is always dangerous. That gets you involved.
And what about the sanctity of treaties? We were in Vietnam because of the treaties.
Nonsense. There's nothing sacred about treaties. Nations break treaties the moment it ceases to be in their interest to obey them.
That has not been true of our nation.
It has been true.
100%.
You never admit it. You always look for a loophole. There's always a loophole. You can always break the treaty in good faith because the other person did not keep his end of it. And there's always, you can always find some petty little thing to prove that he violated it. So you can violate your... and nations do, in fact. No nation is going to allow itself, its vital interests, to be damaged because of a piece of paper. Maybe it shouldn't be that, but that's the way it is. I submit.
Has there ever been a time in history when nations followed the foreign policy on the basis of, just solely on the basis of self-interest?
I think through most of history, nations have predominantly used the national interest as the touchstone of foreign policy. I don't know if there's ever been any period when they've done it more carefully and single-mindedly and rationally than any other period. I just do feel that in this century, this touchstone has been abandoned much more than it had been abandoned in the previous century.
Well, in the Crusades, maybe another area where it was abandoned?
Yeah, of course, those were not national wars, but they certainly were crusades. You know,
but I mean, it was still more based on the irrational considerations. Yeah.
You're quite right. You're more likely to get rationality if there's a balance, a fairly equal power between a number of states and also a community of culture. In the Greek period, the common thing if one city conquered another was to sell all the population into slavery. Well, Sparta defeated Athens, and the Athenians expected that. But Sparta refused to destroy the glory of Greece and merely put a breach in the Athenian walls. There was a community of interest which Sparta respected, and she was not going to go to the ultimate one. But also, there was a fair balance of power between the Greek states. And the theory of the just war, which had some reality, worked better among the Greek city-states than between Rome and Palestine, because Rome was too big and Palestine too small, with your analogy of the big little boy. The great states don't negotiate. It's the fairly equal ones. In history, it's been true. And it became a reality again in the Renaissance period with five Italian city-states, which were fairly well balanced. They used to have wars in the summertime, the main object of which was to make captives, and then they'd barter them off and settle down again for the winter.
I'm still confused, Paul, and I'm sure you aren't disappointed that you raised questions. From the standpoint of a Christian, is it always necessary that we preserve the self-interest of the nation? Well, is a nation holy?
No,
it
is not holy.
I'm overstating.
Yeah. From the standpoint of the Christian, I just don't understand what that can mean. You see, you can sacrifice your life, but what Christian principle can ever require you to sacrifice my life? You are not identical with the nation. The nation is 200 million people besides yourself. Even if all the Christians in the United States decided that Christianity demanded that we sacrifice, that we reduce ourselves to poverty, and maybe give up our lives, could we say that Christianity demanded that we give up the lives and the property also of all the non-Christians in the nation? A nation is a useful, functionally entity expressed by certain important communities of interest. And I think it's a tragedy when any nation is destroyed or so seriously disrupted that it ceases effectively to function. And it's very, very difficult on rational grounds and impossible on Christian grounds to say that it is necessary that a nation give up its life or its integrity, some vital interest.
Well,
The nations are trapped in all of the ambiguities of sinful existence. But they are good gifts of God. I'm terribly conservative on this. Seems to me that it's obvious. The nation is a good gift of God. A nation unified. Without the nation, we would have even more conflict with this union. It is just that at the present historical moment, the international arena is the place where conflict breaks out. It used to be the interurban area or the interprovincial area.
Paul, don't personify a nation that way. I mean, don't speak of a nation as if it were a person. Then you don't have to worry about whether or not it's Christian. You were talking about its interests, you see, and the nation does this. Think of the nation as simply being a system or a technique, like any other tool that we're given to work with. Then worry about the motivations of the people who are using the tools. And then you don't get these hang-ups that they're throwing at you. Because basically, you're right. You're confused. But you're right, basically.
I accept correction. I eliminate that confusion.
Yes, sir.
I want to ask a question, Mark. I take the basis to be that nations ought to act in self-interest.
Well, those in charge of foreign policy.
Don't let him hook you on that, see?
Those in charge of
that's
foreign
a false
policy.
Premise.
Those in charge of foreign policy ought to decide upon the techniques of diplomacy that they will employ on the basis of their assessment of the national interest.
Fine. Is that ought an ethical ought?
Yeah, sure. I expect it.
You're arguing for basic moral principle.
The principle, moral ethic principle, or call it that, is that people who are elected to do a job want to do the job.
If they don't, throw them out. Whatever it is, time.
As you're arguing in a straight line, you're against action on the basis of moral principle.
I'm arguing against constructing foreign policy. I'm arguing that the people who construct foreign policy and are responsible for its implementation ought to use the national interest as the criteria of policy, not some kind of moral consideration.
What is moral consideration?
All right, you can call that. You can say there's one moral principle that I insist upon, that diplomatists should not use morality.
Is that you're arguing for one moral principle rather than another, and you're arguing that what was presented as a moral principle is not workable on this level. There is no such thing as that. There is a morality on this level, and this is the kind of morality that it is.
Okay.
In other words, what you're arguing is that for a good many years, we have been fed a false morality.
Okay.
And that the real morality, that there is a morality there, but it is the morality of national self-interest. Mm.
I don't like that way of putting it, but I'll...
Well, the same thing applies to war. You made some comments about, you know, war and morality are incompatible, but there's a morality of warfare also, which most nations recognize. There are certain things you do and don't do when you fight a war.
Could you give me one there?
Well, it is not an approved of practice to take no prisoners.
What?
Well, it is, I think, when you discuss this among generals, you discuss it among political leaders and so on, they will say it's immoral.
Yeah, they will say that. But they take prisoners because, for one thing, if we don't take prisoners, the enemy will stop taking prisoners. As a matter of fact, very often we do not take prisoners. When it is inconvenient to carry them back, we kill them. Nations have done this. Our nation,
sure, certainly, but we do not operate as a general principle. We do not accept this as a general principle and take no prisoners. We tended to operate up until various stages of World War II, making a distinction between the civilian and the military. and we attempted to amend civilian casualties as non-participants in the war. This is a moral principle.
Yeah, but as soon as expediency, expedient considerations caused that distinction to be blurred, this was completely blurred. We engaged in saturation politics.
In Vietnam?
No, I'm talking about World War II.
We are fighting rather inconveniently in Vietnam, aren't we? And there are a lot of principles that we are, that we don't have to go by, that we are going by.
I just don't know what they are.
Well, this is one.
People are maybe fundamentally decent. Most people would rather not take a life than take it. And this is operative at the level, yes, it's operative at the level of individual decision. The individual captain who takes prisoners doesn't want to, he recognizes these as people. And therefore he instructs his troops to take them back and detain them, don't kill them.
These are some of the conventions that we recognize.
There are conventions, but they are only conventions.
Sure.
As soon as it ceases to be convenient to obey the conventions, nations quickly scrap them.
Well, I don't think that's true at all, Bob. I think that what is going to happen is that very, very seldom this has been the case. I can think offhand of already two examples. One is the Assyrians, who didn't last very long, and the other is Hitler. Who introduced saturation bombing as a terror device to immobilize a country.
That's very interesting. Hitler took prisoners.
Well, sure. Well, no, we're talking about civilian.
Well, why does Hitler obey one moral principle and not another? To call Hitler a moral individual,
he didn't.
He did take prisoners. The Nazis did take prisoners.
No, but not for moral reasons.
That's what I'm arguing. Not for moral reasons.
Well, I cited Hitler and the Assyrians as about the only examples that I can think of where there were not conventions that were generally accepted that were followed. Things are inconvenient to a nation in warfare or involve some inconvenience if they toss aside conventions. And I'm arguing that they generally don't. But there are a great many principles of morality that operate in warfare. And granted, it's a peculiar kind of a situation. But we do attempt to, take Truman's argument. I don't know whether Truman was serious about it or not, whether he meant it or not, about the dropping of the bomb. Let's assume that he was honest about it and that it was a moral decision and that he was right. When he dropped the bomb, sacrificed a certain number of lives in order to save a person more. Okay. Well, there's a threat of morality operative here. I mean, morals don't go out the window when you start a war.
Well, there's a threat of morality running through all human decisions for which we can be grateful. When the morality is the kind of which we approve. You see, there are individuals who believe that morality requires them to stab all the captives that they take in war. So we'd be grateful for this kind of morality.
Of course, this business of sacrificing one to save a lot, that's all the tip is used. It may have a price to the cross, but really, that particular argument.
But it was a valid argument.
Yeah, I agree.
You're going to miss all the goodies over there.